I remember I liked them selling out. Like, I was like, oh, wow, they're going to become really popular. And everyone will like my favorite band, too, and I'll be cool. You know, and, like the first time I heard Nothing Else Matters, I was like, oh, my God, he's singing. Wow, that's so good. He's actually singing. And, you know, he goes soft in the chorus of Unforgiven. And I was like, wow, he's really, he's so emotional. That's me.
Yeah. 93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hayden. Never shine doing what I've shown. Never free, never me. So I don't need you. This is the Celebration Rock Podcast, presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Steven Hayden. My guest today is Drew McGarry, a writer for Deadspin, writer for GQ, the author of the new book, The Hike. He's a great writer. I'm sure many of the listeners of this podcast probably know his stuff. He's laugh out loud funny, and I'm excited to have him on the podcast. Before we get to him, I want to tell you about our sponsor for this week's episode, which is Blue Apron. And Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And they achieve this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. And basically what they do is they send you a bunch of delicious food every week. So you don't have to go to the grocery store, you don't have to like figure out how to make this stuff. They send you the food, they tell you how to make it, and it's really great meals. I've done it myself, made meals for my family, and it's stuff that I would never be able to make on my own. And these are some of the meals that they're offering this month. They have spiced pork burgers with goat cheese and cucumber corn salad. They have chicken tinga tacos with summer squash and tomato salsa. And man, my mouth is watering just talking about this stuff. Now, the way that you can get going on Blue Apron is you go to blueapron.com/celebration and you will get your first three meals for free. You get free shipping. It's just a great way to get started with Blue Apron. So again, you just want to go to blueapron.com/celebration. Again, that's blueapron.com/celebration, and you will get delicious food sent right to your door. Okay, so my guest again, it's Drew McGarry from Deadspin, and I wanted him on my podcast because he recently wrote a really great story about seeing Guns N' Roses in Washington, D.C., and, you know, I've had a couple of guests now who have seen this tour, and everyone comes away raving about it. And it's making me feel bad that I have not seen this show yet. So I thought it'd be a fun opportunity to talk to Drew about Guns N' Roses as well as Metallica. And by the way, both of those bands put out pivotal records 25 years ago in 1991 around this time. You have Guns N' Roses with the Use Your Illusion albums, Metallica with the Black Album era records. So I knew Drew would have opinions about these because he has opinions on everything. So we talked a lot about that, and it was a lot of fun. Of course, we also talked about some non-music related topics because, you know, I talked to Drew on Friday, and it was the day after it was announced that Gawker.com will be ceasing operations. And, you know, Drew writes for Deadspin, which is a separate site from Gawker, but, you know, there's a obvious close relationship between those sites. So I was curious about what his feelings were at this time. You know, it's a pretty tumultuous time in the media, and he's... he has sort of an inside view of that. So we talked a lot about that as well. So this was a really fun conversation, and here it is. Well, Drew, thank you so much for coming on. You know, it's fun to talk to you. I've only emailed with you a bit over the years.
Yeah, are you still in Milwaukee?
No, I'm in Minneapolis.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, are you from Minneapolis or you're from Minnesota, I know?
I grew up in suburban Minneapolis, so Wayzata.
Oh, Wayzata. Okay, so I'm living... I live in like one of the western suburbs.
Oh, all right, okay. Which one?
Well, right now I live in Crystal, but I'm moving in a couple weeks to New Hope.
Yeah, no, I know all those suburbs. Yeah.
Okay. Do you ever get back here?
No, I was gonna go back. I was gonna go back for Brett Favre's first game as a Viking against the Packers.
Oh wow!
In the Metrodome, and when I got to Dulles, we realized that AJ had booked the flight for a week later by accident. So
okay,
and that's when I would have gone back, and I didn't.
Well, as a Packers fan, I'm glad you missed that because that was that was a humiliating day for us. I don't remember the score, but it was I know Favre just destroyed us that day.
He did. It was great.
So, I mean, did you instantly revert into a Brett Favre fan as soon as you joined the Vikings, or was that like a gradual process for you?
No, it was gritted teeth. You know, like I hated him, but I hated him, but I used him for, it was like mercenary type stuff, you know?
Right.
I don't like this guy, but I'm going to use him for my football pleasure, and I'll accept it like that. Did we start? Do you want to start?
Oh, no, we're going, yeah.
Great.
This is part of the, you know, this is like the casual conversational part before we get into the meat.
The small talk. Before we get into the aggressive recording and all that stuff.
I mean, I'm excited to talk to you because I've been reading you for a long time. I've been reading Deadspin, I think, even before you started there, like in like 05, 06, like around the time it got started.
Yeah, that's when I started. I started as a commenter there, so I was a commenter before I was a writer there.
Like, when did you become a writer there?
Well, I was in advertising at the time, and I had like a Blogspot site. And back then, like when you commented, your name would go, if you commented at Deadspin, your name would go, if people clicked on your name or your handle, it would go right to your blog.
Yeah.
Which was cool. It was like, it was fun to comment, but it was also like, also a good little sort of a pimping vehicle, you know? If you had a clever comment, then someone would go to your blog and like it and all that stuff. So that was like 2006. And, oh, by the way, Deadspin is not dead. I got like 400 people yesterday tweeting at me like, oh, so Deadspin's gone, huh?
Well, yeah,
like,
I mean.
No!
I mean, I was going to get into this, you know, and I guess you just opened the door. I mean, we're talking on Friday, and it's the day after it was announced that Gawker will be ceasing operations, I guess, next week. It'll be the week that this podcast goes up.
Gawker.com, correct.
Yeah, and as you said, people are wondering about Deadspin, if Deadspin is done, but like Deadspin was part of the package of Gawker Media blogs that was purchased by Univision.
Yes, that's right. Univision bought everything except Gawker.com, which will be left behind and shuttered. So, but everyone, like Cardinals fans were like, oh, you can't hear this anymore, buddy. Like on Twitter. And then they were like, who's going to tell them? Just tell them that this site is actually fine and going to a nice place.
I mean, you know, there is, again, the separation between Deadspin and Gawker.com, of course, but I mean, you know, you've been at Deadspin for a long time. I'm sure you know a lot of people that work at Gawker, and it's my understanding that they aren't losing their jobs, that they're going to be working elsewhere, but I'm just like, what are your feelings about all this? I mean, what's it like being on the inside of this,
you know,
right now?
It was funny, like back in the day, like when I started at Deadspin, I had no contact with anyone else at Gawker. Like I would send my shit to Will Leach, and he would post it, and that was kind of it, you know? That was, like, before Slack, and it was before Campfire and group chats, and I also wasn't on salary. I was, you know, I would get paid X amount to write my stupid column and then go about my business. And, you know, and gradually, as it became more of a company, I mean, when they started out, I don't think they even had an office, you know? And then they had an office, and then people started going to the office. Then we got group chats and healthcare and stuff like that, and it became more of, okay, this is a job and these are coworkers and people I'm with and stuff like that. And I think yesterday people were very sad because there are people who were written for Gawker and they're going to be, you know, sort of shuffled around to other sites, but there's, you know, there's still some fear and uncertainty because there's new owners and stuff like that, and everyone is, you know, sort of wants the best for them on their behalf too. And also, I wrote a few things for Gawker, so like, you know, I was someone who read it, and you know, and just like anybody else, you read it, and some of the stuff you like, some of the stuff you're outraged by, some of the stuff you're sort of meh about. But it was nice to have there. It was nice to have the option of going there. So it was. I think it was a rough day at the company because I think, you know, it was just one of those things. People at the site felt some ownership of it and were sad to see it go.
Yeah.
And the circumstances of it, with a fucking deranged billionaire using a horny wrestler to bring it down. You know, it was, yeah. I mean, just everyone's just walking around like, can you fucking believe this shit?
Yeah. You know? Well, yeah, I mean, that's crazy. And, you know, again, Gawker and Deadspin being two separate websites, but I mean, there is sort of this unifying, I guess, ethos in a way between the sites, and that, you know, it's speaking truth to power. It's being an outsider. It's like not sort of paying the normal niceties that you see in the media towards, you know, these powerful institutions. Working at Deadspin, I mean, do you feel any chilling effect because of the Gawker
situation? Like, has there ever been a feeling of like, well, can we really be the Deadspin that we've always been? Or are you just sort of ignoring what's happened with Gawker and continuing to do what you do?
Yeah, shockingly, there's been very little of that. Like, you know, obviously all the lawsuits and stuff make you somewhat terrified, you know, especially with like AJ's going through now. Because not only in addition to the company being sued, that they sued individuals, they sued Nick and AJ individually, and that's a terrifying thing to deal with. But no, actually, it's been very, very chill. We've still done whatever we wanted to do. You know, certain big stories will still pass through legal for the sake of making sure that they are accurate and stuff like that. But otherwise, no, I have not really felt like we've been hamstrung or I feel sort of skittish about, you know, saying, you know, whatever I say. I think a lot of it, you know, and, you know, I know it's the internet, so it's sort of self-policing. And so, I think I can say what I want, but I still have my own particular moral center, and hopefully that comes through, you know, when I'm writing stuff so that people don't think this I'm just some fucking sociopath. But they might think that anyway, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you're a hilarious writer. I mean, you're writing for Deadspin and also for GQ. You are like one of the sort of laugh out loud writers for me. And like, what makes you such a funny writer is that you are this guy, you aren't afraid to just go after people, you know, in very sort of vulgar terms, sometimes sort of unbridled terms, but you're really good at that. It is interesting though. Like the reason I started emailing you is that you like made fun of me in a column once.
I think it was a Grantland thing. It was back in the Grantland
days. And it was sort of like going to see a comedian that you love, and then like he starts making fun of you when you're in the audience. Like it was like a combination.
Sorry.
It was like it was partly an honor, and like partly like a nightmare. Like, oh my god, this guy, he's got me. I'm just wondering.
No,
but like being the kind of writer that you are, do you end up in situations where you have to like meet the people that you've written about? And is that awkward or is that fun? Like, what's that process like?
It can be awkward sometimes, sure. Like, I met Peter King, and it was sufficiently awkward. I met your boy Simmons for half a second. Like when there was the Super Bowl weekend, we crashed the Grantland Super Bowl party.
Right.
The whole Deadspin staff just utterly shit faced, and they were on their way out of the bar, and I saw Simmons, and I said hey, and he said hey, and we shook hands, and then he was gone, and then I was. At the bar drinking more. And yeah, it's all the standard. It's just as awkward as you would have it believe. And it's that sort of thing where, you know, the old sports writer ethos was you rip a guy and then you're back in the locker room the next day, you know, and you, it's what real men do. And I don't think that serves anybody well. Like I all of a sudden, you know, this weird adversarial sort of dance between a columnist and an athlete becomes its own, that, you know, everything gets framed through that relationship, which literally no one else gives a shit about in the world, you know?
Right, right.
So I'm willing to, you know, have those awkward exchanges with people that I have criticized, and I deserve every bit of that awkwardness. But then there's also the distance of being a reader. You know, you want to be in the fan's shoes. You want to be in the reader's shoes of someone who doesn't have any access and read something and is like, this is bullshit, you know?
Right.
That might be how something makes you feel, you know? And so, yeah, so it's sort of a mix. I think you need to be willing to look people in the eye after you've ripped them. But I don't think that I'm under any obligation to, you know, to have eternal access to people.
Well, yeah, I mean, and again, I think that willingness to go there, to sort of be fearless in that way, is what makes your writing so good and funny. Like, that's what I like about it. I'm just wondering if that gets more difficult as you know, get more successful, you know, because like when you were getting started as a commenter, obviously you could just say whatever you wanted and you were never going to run into anybody. But now that you are, you're better known, you know, you've got like 125,000 Twitter followers or whatever. I mean, it seems like that it's more likely now that you'll see these people. I just wonder if there's even something inside of you, like that Midwestern
you know, background that you have that's like, you know, maybe I have to pull my punches a little bit more now.
No, I have that genteelness, like, in person. Like, I have that phony waltz. I do that phony waltz bullshit in person. And, oh, so good to see you. Walk away. I'm like, the guy's an asshole. But, no, I don't feel hamstrung. No, I don't feel more hamstrung than 10 years ago. I think, I think the only thing I'm more sensitive to is just, all right, am I being a dick? You know, like, am I being an unreasonable dick?
Yeah.
I think I have a better sense of that now than I had, you know, back in the KFK days and stuff like that, where you're just shooting off at everybody and being a dick. And it was sort of, you know, it was 2006. Like, it was, you know, the internet was meaner and, you know, I think...
You think it was meaner in 06 than it is now?
Yes. I legitimately think it was much meaner. I legitimately think there was a lot less sensitivity, you know?
Is that because of social media? Like, there's more eyes on it now?
I think there's more people willing to speak up and say, no, what you're saying is hurtful and shitty, you know? Like, I mean, remember Team America? Like, Team America has, like, gay jokes all over it, right?
Right.
They would never make that movie again, you know? There's just a certain inherent sensitivity now that's good, I think. And I think that people like me, and there's a lot of other people, are, you know, have sort of grown with the internet. And that doesn't mean that there aren't, you know, completely insane Twitterheads out there or horrible commenters, but they get called out. And there are people less afraid to say this is bullshit and willing to suffer the blowback for it. So,
yeah,
I think the only thing that has changed, are decisions that I want to make because I'm a little bit different. I'm not that different. I'm still a dick, but it's the way that I'm different now than I was maybe 10 years ago.
Right.
You know, I'm not, you know, you start out and it's like I'm doing like a dad blog and, you know, I just gotten off of like, you know, reading like Tucker Max for the first time and like his sushi stories and like, you know, and I'm like, fat bro, and you know, you're doing all that bro humor and that really, you know, has become sort of passe and to me, like legitimately, there's not like some suppressed bro within me who's like, oh God, I just want to make bro jokes again. Like, I'm just not that person anymore.
Right. Well, I mean, bro humor has become passe, but then you also have things like Barstool Sports, for instance, which seems to do really well with that. Like, it seems like there is still an audience for that to some degree.
Yeah, there's some, but I think it is limited. I think you'll limit yourself, you know? It's like Trump's voting platform ceiling, you know?
We are going to get to music here eventually, but I do want to also ask you about this book that you just put out, The Hike. This is your second novel. And
it is. Ding, ding. Good plug.
Yes, exactly. See, I want to facilitate the promotional process. You know, I know you're not just on my podcast for your health, so I can facilitate the... I know what it's like to sell a book.
It's such a pain in the ass, isn't it? It's awful.
Well, who even buys books? I mean, I'm always amazed that anyone is willing to... you know, spend more than $10 on a book, you know?
Yeah, and there's a whole fucking magic formula that has just eluded me for four books. I don't know what the secret sauce is. You know, you write it and people like it and you think that's enough, but it's not necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, and I now am at the point where it's like, like you're breaking all all your own private Twitter commandments. Like, I'm retweeting compliments, which I fucking hate, but like... But no one's going to sell it for you, you know?
Yeah, like, you're trying to... Yeah, I mean, I do the same thing. I hate retweeting compliments, but you do want to... You do want to tell people that, hey, people are talking about my book. And I don't want to keep telling you to buy my book, but maybe if this other person tells you to buy the book, you'll listen to them and you'll do it.
That's exactly right. It means nothing coming from me. If I tell you, hey, my book's really good, well, no shit, I wrote it, you know? And So then I have to, you know, retweet a comment and I feel like such a self-involved dick doing it. There's no choice. I you know, it's like, you know, I want to tell people, listen, I'll stop worrying the second you buy it. It's like a hostage situation. Like,
right.
Don't want me retweeting, but just buy the fucking book.
Right. Well, you just got to think I'm retweeting it for my kids, you know?
Yep.
I'm not doing
right.
it for me. It's, you know, so that they can have a roof over their heads. You know, I haven't read the book yet, so I can't really, I'm sure it's great. And I think everyone...
Well, shithide.
Everyone, no. Well, you know, everyone listening should buy the book. but I admire you a lot for, you know, you've written like nonfiction books. You've written like, you wrote a book about being a dad. You wrote a book about being a sports fan. And you've written these novels. To me, writing a novel just seems so daunting and impossible. I mean, do you find that fiction writing is more difficult than writing for the web or writing, you know, the nonfiction books? Or, I mean, is it just a different thing? I mean, to me, it seems way harder.
Well, yeah, it's daunting in the sense that obviously it's much longer, right? It has to be rewritten a bazillion times because it's being formally presented and put in print for posterity forever. So you want it to be just right. So there's a lot of hammering out of, you know, of sentences and making sure that everything sort of fits together and making sure everything's coherent. And there are, you know, a trillion different directions you can take the story, and any wrong turn fucks the rest of it up, and you have to go back, and that's a pain in the ass. But then it's also freeing because there's no timetable. You're not reacting to news. It doesn't have to go up right away. It's no deadline. It doesn't have to be about anything going on in the universe. You can live in this world that's inside your head for a little bit and sort of space out, and that's fun. I mean, even now, you know, I have no interest in cracking open the book again because I've read it 100 times. But, you know, once in a while, you know, if I feel like getting away, I can sort of go into that sort of headspace, and that's nice. Even with Postmortal, I can sort of, you know, throw on some Mastodon or something and sort of think about that universe for a bit. And it's just, it's oddly comforting to sort of have that place to escape into in your imagination. Especially after you've gone through the process, the world in your headspace gets a bit more fully formed.
Yeah.
And it just feels like a nice place you can sort of go visit in your mind every now and again. So it's actually it's a bit of a nice break. It's slower pace, slower build. You can do what you want, but at the same time, you know, there's always that awareness of making sure the story's coherent and, you know, and plays by some and has some degree of structure so that people enjoy reading it. And no, I especially with this one, I really did enjoy sort of, sometimes you discover it almost like a reader, you discover the story as you're writing it, and that's sort of how this went.
Would you say, like, if you had your druthers, like, would you just write novels?
Or,
I mean,
no.
Because obviously you have to work in order to make a living and
right.
have health benefits and all that. So, but you would still want to write about sports and culture in addition to.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think only because I think if I just wrote novels, I would get stuck, you know? And I just think I just like keeping all the muscles worked out in my head, you
yeah.
know? Like a little bit of opinion, a little bit of a feature, a little bit of a newsy thing, quick hits, you know, satire, novels. That's all, you know, it's all like sort of, you know, it sounds sort of beat, but it's like sort of cross-training. It just, I feel sharper. If I just tried to do novels, I think I would get stuck. And even like if I'm on vacation, like if I haven't written in a week, I feel sort of flabby. Like my mind feels sort of out of shape.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
So the way that it's sort of, I've sort of delegated my time now is about as good as I'll get it. And I don't really have much incentive to change it.
Yeah.
Unless someone said, like, here's $1 billion a book, then fuck, I'll write nothing but books.
You sure. will reluctantly sign that contract for...
I would, yes, I would be very, very hesitant.
So, I'm now going to segue to the music part of this conversation.
Sure.
I want to, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, or one of the excuses, I guess, to have you on, is that for GQ, you recently wrote a story about going to see Guns N' Roses in Washington.
It was great.
You see
him?
I haven't seen them. You're the second person to be on my podcast that has seen this tour. And, you know, I was very skeptical going into this tour, especially after, like, Axl broke his foot.
Of course.
It just seemed like, okay, here we go again. You know, he's going to fuck it up. It's going to be terrible.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, Axl's had kind of an amazing year. I mean, not only has this Guns N' Roses tour done really well, it's getting really good reviews. People seem to really like it. He's also done a really good job with AC/DC. Like, I don't know if you watch any of those video clips.
I thought that would be a disaster too, and he's actually done a really good job.
No, he's put in the work. I mean, he's old and fat, and he needs fucking 10-minute breaks to rest his voice. But he's still he still has the moments. You know,
he gets up on
the amp and he lets out the scream, and it's like 1991 again. It's pretty cool.
Now, going into that show, I mean, was your thinking that, well, I'm going to go to the show and it's going to be, you know, like a turkey shoot, like it's just going to be terrible and I can write about it and have fun with it? I mean, was that, or were you hoping that it would be good going into it?
No, I was hoping for the best. You know, I was, you know, keep your expectations tempered, but I was legitimately looking forward to seeing them because I had never seen them as a child. And, you know, and then the other thing was, you know, I'm in a parking lot with my people, you know, people who grew up listening to Guns, thinking they're the most dangerous shit on earth. And, you know, and I'm talking to the fans, we're all sort of reacting the same sort of, taking the time machine back to 1987 when you first see the tape in the, you know, safety case at Ben Franklin and shit like that. You know, that's part of the experience. So sometimes, you know, I mean, sometimes the music is almost sort of beside the point. You just sort of want to be with your people and sort of live in that nostalgia for a little bit and get shit-faced. And, I mean, let's face it, once you're drunk, the bar for live music is pretty low. You know, if they crank out a couple hits, you're happy, you know? It just happened to be that they really put on a really amazing show in a legitimate effort to make everyone happy. It was pretty cool.
Now, you know, you mentioned Guns N' Roses being one of the sort of defining bands of your youth, and I'm pretty sure we're around the same age. Like, how old are you?
39.
Okay, so we are, I'm going to be 39 in a couple weeks, so we are pretty much exactly the same age. So yeah, Guns N' Roses was huge for me as well. And, you know, we're at an interesting period right now in terms of the sort of album anniversary discussion. You know, the summer of 1991 being a very pivotal summer going into the fall, being a very pivotal period in terms of albums that were released that sort of define, I guess, the new classic rock. Like, if 90s music is the new classic rock, this was, you know, a very pivotal time, because you have, in August and September, you have Metallica's Black Album, you have Pearl Jam 10, you have the Use Your Illusion albums, you have Nevermind from Nirvana, and you have Blood Sugar Sex Magik by Red Hot Chili Peppers.
So was the Black Album not 1990? It was 91?
That was 91, yeah. It was I think it came out like August 12th or something. Like, it's very recent that album just turned 25.
And Nevermind was not 1992. It did break in 1992, but it came out in 1991. Is that the deal?
Yeah, it broke towards the end of 91. Like, there's that famous story about how Michael Jackson's album Dangerous was the number one album in the country over Christmas time, and then Nevermind supplanted it at the top of the chart. So that's sort of always pointed to as the galvanizing moment, you know, the passing of the torch moment.
Yeah, so 1991 was essentially the flip from butt rock to grunge, basically, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was it. And, you know, for people our age, like, you know, I was going into eighth grade at that time. I don't know, you were probably in eighth grade too, maybe?
I was a sophomore. It was my first year of prep school.
Oh, so you were a smart kid. You skipped ahead a little bit.
I skipped third grade because I was a little smart.
Oh, there you go. So, okay, looking at all those albums, you know, looking back, like, what for you are sort of like the pivotal records out of that batch? Like, you're a Guns N' Roses guy, obviously. Like, who else?
Let's see. Well, of those five?
Yeah.
You know, I think, I mean, I tend to be more loyal to the thrash and the hair metal than to the old grunge. Although I liked all of it, I liked Nirvana and I liked Pearl Jam and I liked Alice in Chains a lot, because Alice in Chains was always a bit more metal to me than, they always belonged more with Metallica than with, you know, the bands that they happen to share a locality with, you know?
Right, right.
But I remember, you know, back in those times, like when User Illusion came out, I was huge into it, and I remember, obviously I was huge into the Black Album, and not so much anymore, although
right.
Although I still have the Mexico City Enter Sandman on my, like, on my workout playlist, like when they start off with like the Ennio Morricone score and all that shit, and they go into it, it's like,
yeah,
but I,
yeah.
Like, I don't listen to like Holier Than Thou anymore, I still listen to Puppets and Lightning and all that stuff. And I remember I was so into Illusion 1, Illusion 2 that we would have, like, we had a track we would have to run around, like for wrestling practice and stuff like that. And I didn't have, I don't think I had a Walkman at the time, or you weren't allowed to bring it while you ran, but I would start to finish play, like, Use Your Illusion 2 in my head, you know, like I would try and play it in my mind. Like, I wouldn't be able to listen to it, but I would try to run Locomotive all in time as I was running around. And I remember that very, very distinctly.
Yeah. So, like, you said you were more into, like, the thrash and metal side. So, like, are we talking, like, Anthrax, Megadeth, like, those kind of bands? Or
no,
like, who else?
Mostly Metallica, Van Halen, Def Leppard, like hair metal, too. Guns. Those would be sort of the big ones. Yeah, those.
See, this is interesting, because I feel like when people talk about this period, they tend to be very kind of, you know, black and white terms between, like, the hair metal and the grunge stuff. That there's this idea that grunge came in and then all those other bands just sort of fell off the face of the planet. And I think that for a lot of people that liked grunge music, they just looked at it as hard rock music. So they still liked a lot of those metal bands.
Yeah, that sort of became, too.
And so, I mean, and it sounds like that was true for you.
Yeah, I liked it all. I do remember, and I still feel this way. I feel that, I'm like one of those people who wants rock back, you know? Like, I want the fun times and the party times back. And, you know, the grunge bands were great, and they made really good music, but there was never any stagecraft, right?
Right.
Never any makeup, never any choreography. It was a premium placed on realness and on pain.
Well, and the decadence, and, too, like the sort of, like, flaunting of decadence and, you know, groupies and drugs and all that stuff. It became passé very quickly.
It did. And I do miss, that's the sort of fun element of rock and roll that gets, you know, it gets sort of revived every now and again with, like, the Darkness and the Struts, but I know it'll never be as big as it was, you know, it will never be the behemoth that it was, and the kidney still wants to be that way, but I know it never will.
Right.
And that still appeals to me greatly, because it's just fun and awesome and great.
Now, at that time, I mean, you know, you liked GNR and you liked Metallica. Like, who was the, like, would you say that you preferred one over the other?
Yeah, probably old Metallica, although I loved Guns, too. I wasn't a rival guy. Like, I wasn't, I mean, like, certain things were, like everyone makes fun of Winger, right? Like, oh, Winger sucks, fuck Winger, you know. And you'd have that. But I was never on, like, a team, you know? I wasn't like an Oasis Blur situation where you had to, like, one over the other.
Right. Now, like,
although I fucking hated, like, the Dead, and I hated Fish. Like, that, those were my enemies. Those were my musical enemies.
Right, right. Definitely, anything hippie-ish was, like, verboten.
Yep. Hated hippies.
Like, how about now, like, you know, with Guns N' Roses, like, the Use Your Illusion records or the Black Album? I mean, you kind of talked about the Black Album falling off for you. I mean, at the time, I mean, were you, when the Black Album came out, like, were you already a Master of Puppets guy?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I fucking loved them. I loved them. I loved Justice. I loved all of them. Yeah.
So, like, did you look at Black Album as, like, a sellout record?
No, I loved it. I loved it, and I actually liked, I remember I liked them selling out. Like, I was like, oh, wow, they're going to become really popular, and everyone will like my favorite band, too, and I'll be cool, because everyone likes them, and I like them, too. And I liked all the songs. I liked the album. And, you know, and like the first time I heard Nothing Else Matters, I was like, oh, my God, he's singing. Wow, that's so cool. He's actually singing. And, you know, he goes soft on the chorus to Unforgiven. And I was like, wow, he's really, he's so emotional. That's me. Yeah. So, no, I liked all of it. And I think the only reason I don't listen to it much anymore is just because I played it out so much when I was a kid.
Right.
It's like Nevermind. Like, I'll never really listen to Nevermind again because I played it 4 billion times and I never need to hear it again.
Yeah,
it killed it.
I mean, I feel like that's true of, like, all those records I just mentioned. I mean, you know, I put Blood Sugar Sex Magik in there, even though, like, I don't like the Chili Peppers really anymore. But, like, if I'm being honest, like, when I was 14, like, that was a huge record. That's a record that you'd go to your friend's house, play basketball in their driveway, and that album would be playing.
Like, we would play in the dorm room. He'd be like, wow, they're rapping. It's cool. You know? And I would listen to it. And I remember liking it because they were also, they were their own sort of animal because they were a good time band, but they clearly weren't hair metal. They were something a little bit different.
Right.
You know? So, but I remember liking them too. So I was not, like I said, I was firmly on the side of all rock and anti, like, country, like, which I am to this day.
Right.
And anti, you know, hippie bullshit. And when the really limp 90s bands came along, like Matchbox 20 and like Dishwalla and stuff, I fucking hate them. I still hate those bands. I still blame those bands for a lot of societal ills.
Right. Do you still follow Metallica? Like, they have a new album coming out.
Yes, and I heard the single this morning, and it's not very good. And I thought
it was okay. Maybe I wasn't expecting a ton, but I thought it was pretty solid.
I really liked Death Magnetic, and I thought it was a really good album, and I still listen to some of it. And this one is not produced by Ruben. It's produced by someone who was under him while they were making Death Magnetic. So it sort of has that feel to it. But, you know, I'm not buying James Hetfield saying we're all so effed. I'm not buying it from James Hetfield right now. It's just not, you know. But the riff is good, and I'll give it a chance. Like, there was on the track listing, there was one of the tracks was called Man Unkind, which is pretty bad. That's a pretty bad song title.
I mean, is Metallica a band that you still care about as like a still creative entity, or is it a purely nostalgic exercise for you at this point? If you listen,
I'm always loyal to them, even with Napster and all that stuff. And I hope they make good music. I don't count on it. Do you know what I mean?
Like,
by the time Death Magnetic came out, I didn't have any faith that they would ever record good music again. And then I really liked Death Magnetic, and I was really happy it was there and sort of gave me that, like, scratched that itch that I had from like the 80s, you know. But I think it's best to not, you know, have those demands of a band and let the band be the band. And if they surprise you, you know, by sort of having a strong comeback, they surprise you. And if they don't, they don't. Like, I'm a huge Bob Mould fan. Like, I adore him. I love everything he fucking does. And, you know, there was one point in 1998 where he was going to give up his electric guitar and never make a rock album again. And I was fine with that. I was like, okay, all right, he's not going to do it. And then he's roared back and he's had three straight solo rock albums that are all balls to the wall and amazing, and it's nice to be surprised. It's nice to not demand that. It's nice to be, you know, instead of demanding all the time that your favorite artist, you know, recapture your childhood with every record, it's better if you let them be them, and if they feel like surprising you, that's cool, and if not, you know?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of artists, they go through this period where they feel like they have to be contemporary and change what they were in order to sort of fit with the times, and it almost never works. I mean, to use Metallica as an example, like, I think of that scene in Some Kind of Monster, you know, like, where they're, you know, they're recording Saint Anger, and like, James and Lars don't want to have guitar solos on the record because they're saying that guitar solos are passé. And
Kirk out.
Yeah, Kirk Hammett is like, well, if we don't have guitar solos, that will date the record to now. And, you know, it's better that we just be ourselves because it will seem less dated in retrospect. And it's sort of a Spinal Tap.
Right.
He is right. And, you know, people watch that scene and they laugh at it because it seems sort of Spinal Tap-ish. But at the same time, he's being exactly right. That's, like, great music criticism there, I think.
Well, and I remember, like, Keith Richards in his book was like, you know, like, he was dumping on Mick Jagger because Mick Jagger would hear something on the radio and then come into the studio and be like, we call it this. And he was like, we don't have to do anything. We're the Rolling Stones. And that was always what they would argue about. It was hilarious. And it was true. It was like, there are some people who can shapeshift and remain themselves and try different styles and remain themselves, like David Bowie and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But then there are bands like Metallica who have to be Metallica. And they can't be, you know, they can't be Bob Seger. It's just weird and dumb.
Yeah, totally. You know, going back to Guns N' Roses, you know, the Use Your Illusion albums, you know, I went through, like, when those albums came out, they were maybe the most anticipated albums of my life at that point. Like, I was so excited. There was such a long buildup for it. And I remember, you know, like, the video for You Could Be Mine came out, and that was also teasing Terminator 2, which was like...
Yeah, and it's a great song.
It's a great song. And then, you know, so I loved the albums when they came out, and then I went through a period where I hated the albums. I never wanted to listen to them again. And now lately, last couple of years, when I revisit them, I actually really like listening to them again.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff on those albums. It was a mess. I mean, they recorded it all in different like cities, you know, and everyone had their own songs, and so no one wanted to piss each other off by cutting songs. So they had 4 billion songs on there. If you'd cut it down to 15 songs, you know, it would have been right up there with one of the best albums of its decade.
See, but and I agree with that. But I also like that they put out essentially put out two double albums at once, because you know you talked about how that kind of rock music is gone and it's probably gone forever. I mean, just the idea that like a band was so big that they could be that extravagant.
Yes,
I think that's a lot of what I love about those albums now, is that they feel like sort of a last gasp in a way of that sort of grandiose stadium rock.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there are other albums like that. I think like Oasis did Be Here Now,
right?
That had $10 million worth of cocaine in it.
Right.
And there are those albums have their place. Those sort of grandiose, you know, where the song that should be 3 minutes long is 7 minutes long. You know, like I do have a soft spot for some of those, especially when the song like Locomotive is 8 minutes long, but I love it. I love every minute of that song.
I mean, do you know? Kind of getting back to this idea of like of 90s rock being like the new classic rock, like do you feel any weirdness about that this is sort of like the new Zeppelin or Grand Funk Railroad or something, that you know,
well,
that,
old.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, is there any vanity of, like, or do you welcome that, like, okay, I'm an old guy and I like listening to this stuff?
I think you have to accept it, right? It's old, you know, it's for old dudes. And if you want to feel younger, you want to feel newer, then it's on you to find the new music you like, you right. know. Like, I listen to the Struts, and I feel like I'm 25, because they're new, and they're fun, and they're exciting.
I mean,
I'm not some old dad just pining for 1987 to exist in perpetuity, you know? I think that's what ages people more than the music itself, you know?
Right. I mean, do you still seek out new bands? I mean, you mentioned the Struts.
Yes.
I mean, so, and I know you're a Mastodon fan. Like, what kind of stuff do you look for now in music? I mean, is it something, are you looking for an element that you loved from the past that's sort of like brought into the present, or I guess what draws you to music now?
All I want is some semblance of production, right? I don't want to sound like it was produced in a garbage can. Like it should be some professionalism in the production. There should be good guitarists, and then there should be actual singing. Like, I can't tell you the number of metal bands that have utterly fantastic instrumentation, and then the Cookie Monster vocals come in and you're like, well, you're not trying, there's no contrast here, you know? Like, Queens of the Stone Age are a great band because they lay down these heavy riffs and then there's crooning over it, right? That's
right.
What makes it cool. And that's what gives it some depth, you know? Whereas if I'm, you know, if the vocalist is just thrashing tunelessly to the guitars, that doesn't do anything for me. Like, I need some semblance of songcraft and production all packaged in something that feels like it has some muscle to it. I think that's generally what I look for. And I don't, you know, I want it to be sort of motivating. I want to run through a fucking wall every time I hear it. I don't want some limp-ass Rob Thomas thing going on.
What are your feelings about, like, indie rock? You know, because, like, for instance, like, this year, like, the big indie rock record is probably, like, Car Seat Headrest. And that's a record I love a lot. But, you know, it's a guy with glasses who's young. He's not very rock and roll in the way that we're talking about. Is that something that appeals to you at all, or do you look at that as more of kind of like a limp thing?
It depends. Like, I really like Japandroids, right? Because they're all, like, they get out and they tear the joint down, right? That's a great band. And I think, what was the one, the album last year that's already gone? Beach Slang, are they?
Oh, yeah, they have a record coming out in September, which is awesome.
I liked them. They were all right. So I'm fine with that, so long as, you know, I think, you know, it's like the old Husker albums, like the production was shit, and even Bob Mould would have acknowledged that, but you could tell that there was a pop sensibility to it. The idea that someone was playing something that they want people to listen to. That's what I'm looking for in everything. Like, if I'm reading a book, I want to know that the writer thought about me when they were writing it and not about winning like an award. Or if I watch a movie, I want to know that the director cares about me and that he's not just trying to get a bunch of cool shots for his reel. You know, like I, I want the confidence that the person telling me the story or recording the song, you know, is looking out for me and is giving me the confidence that I need to keep going along with them on whatever journey they're taking me on.
What was the process for you of like writing your first novel, The Postmortal? Because I know Mastodon played an inspirational role for that. I mean,
right.
was that a matter of just hearing the record and feeling like, and kind of getting an idea for the book? I mean, or did you listen to the albums as you wrote the book? Like, how did that inform what you wrote?
It was more like sort of like you see the movie in your head and that's the soundtrack, you know?
Right.
The idea came from like a news segment. So, but then there was, you know, there were, I think also with books now, I think it's better when books are not, they don't have to just be influenced by other books, you know? Like you can be influenced by, you know, I think there was a lot of 60 Minutes in that book. There was a lot of, blogs in that book, like HuffPo. There was Gawker in there. You know, and I think it's more interesting now if a book has sort of a range of influences. Like if you read Ready Player One, it's pretty clear that it's all video game influence, and it reads like that, and that's sort of fun. It's a different way of approaching it that I think is sort of cool and interesting. But it doesn't just have to be, you know, Dickens, you know, rehashed fart sniffing every time you read.
Like, what was it about Mastodon's music that made you want to plug it into that story?
Well, it was just the feel of it, because it was all dark, brooding metal, and it was sort of, like, there's a whole concept story behind that album that's completely insane. Like, it's got Rasputin, like, the ghost of Rasputin, and
we're talking about Leviathan.
All this stuff.
We're talking about Leviathan, by the way. This is the 2004.
No, this is Crack the Sky.
Oh, Crack the Sky, right, okay, that's right.
It was all Crack the Sky, mostly.
And that was the one about, like, the drummer's... his sister.
His sister had committed suicide, I believe. But then they also had this weird, you know, drug-induced storyline about Rasputin going into space and
right.
all this stuff. And it had nothing to do. It had, you know, lyrically had nothing to do with the story of The Postmortal. It just had that sort of mood to it, where it was very big and very grand, and very. You know, it just felt like gigantic chess pieces of the world were being moved around, you know, and that was sort of the feel that I was going for in the book, you know, where you feel the world shifting under you, but you can't quite see it, you know, so that was part of it.
Yeah, I think one thing that sets Mastodon apart, and this is an underrated, I think, element of a lot of music, is that they have great drumming. And that seems to be something that's like missing in a lot of bands now. Like the drummer is never like there. Many like even good bands don't have great drummers.
Yeah, and I have a bad time sensing that. Like they'll always tell you, "Oh, well, Charlie Watts is the Secret of the Stones." And you're like, "Really? the weird drummer guy, like the quiet drummer guy?" But it's true. Like when I remember Bob Mould wrote that in his book. Like he had a drummer that he sort of liked, and then he replaced him with John Worcester from Superchunk. And it was like night and day. Like he felt like there was a spine all of a sudden to the music. And that I do recognize that now. You know, like some of the Oasis albums, and they would have session drummers, but it would sound like they were blasting through the stadium. And it, like that sort of authority that the drums have, I think really does it does lend itself well. I do appreciate a good rhythm section.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you know, I always like talking about rhythm sections with other 39-year-old men.
You that's
know,
right.
That's some...
We're all right.
It's
too late. All right, Dad, right. Never feel young again.
Maybe that might be a good note to end on here. I know you got to get going. So, but Drew, thank you so much for coming on, man. It was so fun talking with you. And again, the book is called The Hike, and everyone should buy it. So,
thanks, Hayden.
So Drew can keep writing books. All right, man, thanks. Take care, dude. All right, that was Drew McGarry. Great guest, a lot of fun talking with him. And again, buy his book, The Hike, Keep His Children Fed. Anything you can do for Drew would be much appreciated. He is a friend of this podcast. Guys, thank you so much for listening this week. And, you know, I just want to thank you again for your support. It really means a lot. It keeps this podcast going. And anything you can do to help support us would be very much appreciated. And, you know, what I mean by that is, you know, just tell people about the podcast, spread the word, you know, talk about us on social media. If you have time, you know, leave a review or even just a rating on iTunes. All these things help
support and grow the podcast. And it really means a lot. So if you could do that, that would be great. I also want to mention, since we are selling books on this podcast, that I have my own book that came out in May. It's called Your Favorite Band is Killing Me. It's a book about music rivalries, a collection of essays. There's about 20 or so rivalries that I talk about in the book. And basically, if you like this podcast, I think you'll like the book. It's a version of me talking about music, except it's in print. So I think you will enjoy it. And it doesn't cost that much either. It's very cheap. So please check it out. Otherwise, guys, thank you so much for checking out this episode of Celebration Rock. As always, it was a blast, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week.